Today we're going to seek to answer a question that a listener sent to us. This is a tough question, and many times with tough questions, I kind of want to shrink away because I don't think I'm bright enough. But what I've found over my life is that I need to stick with questions. I need to think about them. I need to understand them. I think that's what the gospel requires.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
Throughout the years that we've been broadcasting this program, we've often asked for listener response, and we've got a lot of response from a lot of people. Actually, we'd like more than we already have, so please keep writing or calling or asking us questions. We love it. Early in the summer, we received a great letter from a listener, and I'd like to read the opening line. He said, "You encourage listener response, but this may not be the type of response you find rewarding." And I have to strongly disagree with you. On one hand, yes, we do receive and encourage listener response, as I just said, but wow, we want you to ask these kind of questions all the time. Your letter was very rewarding. It was very encouraging to hear your questions. They were very thoughtful. They made a lot of sense to us, and we'd like to go over them on the radio today. I'd like to say that Jack was going to write and tell you that we loved this letter, but
he's flaky.
What can we say? No, I don't really agree that you're flaky. I think that life is just really, really full, yeah. And we just can't take care of everything. And I don't think that's flakiness. And actually, I'm kind of serious about that subject right before addressing this letter, Jack. I think when we don't get to some things, we call ourselves flaky, then I think that can be discouraging to people who, like us, who are trying with everything we have to keep up with life, and we just can't. Now, there's some people who are just really lazy and don't, but there's a lot of people that are really trying to keep up with life.
And overwhelmed. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, and I think you're in that category.
Well, thank you. I hope so.
I don't think you're flaky at all.
I hope so.
But I see you very busy in trying to address important issues in your own life and to try and wade through the many requests you get for your time.
You know, I considered actually writing a response to this letter, but the questions are so deep and so profound and so involved that it just seemed more efficient to actually talk and not write something out and have a conversation with you. Mm-hmm. Plus, the questions are kind of unusual, and so I think they'll be kind of new and different and refreshing on Christian radio. So,
well, I don't know if I agree with you on that. I don't know if they're new. I think that they're questions that are good.
Yeah.
They're thoughtful. They're probably not often addressed because they're big ones, especially on Christian radio, but I think that these questions really will be helpful to a lot of listeners.
Yeah, I hope so.
A lot of people that think about this. And I think that's one of the reasons we wanted to address it over the radio, too. Is that right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because we think it'd be helpful. We think it'd be helpful to a lot of people. One of the things that this person said is, "I am amazed at the difference between my perception of gospel-accepting Christians and the gospel you are discussing." He goes on to say that most of the Christians that he hears match every stereotype of vicious, ignorant, narrow-minded, right-wing bigots, although they mask their message. He goes on to say that it's an ugly message that he usually hears from Christianity. It's encouraging on one hand that he sees us as people who are being thoughtful and trying to address questions authentically, really, with thought. It's also a big responsibility, and these questions are hard, and I would hope that in trying to discuss them today, if we fall short of people's expectations, that you will write and help us keep thinking, because that's what we want to do. We don't want to end up bigoted, right-winged, unthoughtful people. We want very much to be people who are really looking at life and at the gospel and who God is, and I'm taking it very seriously.
This person identifies themselves, and this is not your typical Christian radio station listener. The person identifies himself as a Berkeley East Coast Jewish communist in background. So one thing that I will say is that to some extent I understand what he's saying about is thinking that all these various radio personalities fit a stereotype of vicious, ignorant, narrow-minded, right-wing bigots. And to a certain extent, I understand that. But having been raised in a fundamentalistic, religious right-type culture, I think it's one of those cultures that's greatly misunderstood. It's easy to misunderstand that culture. Most of the people in that culture are very well-intentioned and very, very kindly and compassionate in their everyday lives and their everyday interactions with people, and they really do mean well. I don't recognize them when I hear descriptions of them as narrow-minded right-wing bigots who are ignorant. It's an anti-intellectual culture. That is true. And so there is a kind of ignorance and there's a kind of narrow-mindedness, and we'll be talking about that a little bit. But it doesn't come out of bigotry, and it doesn't come out of hatred, and it doesn't come out of some kind of unwillingness to be open to other people who are coming from different cultures and some and different points of view. I realize their rhetoric, especially in the climate, the social political climate that we're in, can really sound that way, and I understand that. But as somebody who was nurtured in that culture, I really think it's misunderstood. I'm the first to criticize it. I have a lot of problems with it. I have a lot to say about how wrong it is in so many respects, but I'm not sure this is one of them. There are people within it, like there are people within any culture, who are hateful and who are bigoted, but it's not because of the culture, it's because we're people. The culture itself is quite willing to promote compassion and mercy and warmth toward other people. You look like you don't agree.
Well, it's not that I'm not agreeing, it's that I'm thinking, and maybe that's just kind of a new look here. I think one of the reasons that we, as a Christian community, look really bigoted and hateful has a lot to do not just with the culture, but with our sin. And what wells up inside each of us, what shows itself, is our sin in everyday life. And so I'm kind of agreeing and disagreeing with you at the same time, Jack. I think that this isn't a necessarily different culture than anywhere else. I think it's certainly been identified as a more hateful culture that lacks compassion and that's very bigoted. I know that we're targeted in that way. I don't think we're different than right. many, many other cultures. I think that we are, as a human creature, very bigoted because we're very afraid people. And when we have something we want to stand on and believe in, it gets very threatening to us when somebody thinks differently than us, and it can topple us in very, very big ways. And because of that, I think that there is a lot of hate that exudes in the Christian culture. I see it in every other culture.
Right.
But I certainly think it's there also when people say that they see it. I can't deny it. I can't even deny it myself sometimes, that I'm a hateful or hurtful person, that I'm bigoted. I think that what's different, hopefully, about Christians is that I want to see where I'm wrong, and I honestly want to face it. But I'm not going to not see it. I mean, it's not going to not be there.
Right, right.
It's just, I think it's very much got at work in my life to help me look at it and see it and want to be different, not want to be bigoted, not want to be hateful, not want to be unforgiving. That's the important difference between a person who's being changed by the Spirit of God and someone who is not.
Right. Yeah, the important point, though, is that, as you point out, to the extent that we are bigoted, it's because we're people. It's because we're human beings. We're sinful human beings. It's not because we're Christians.
Exactly.
I mean, it's not our Christianity that makes us bigoted. It's our humanity that makes us bigoted.
That's what I was trying to say. Better said.
And our Christianity actually, I mean, this is what's not understood in the critique of Christianity by the larger culture, is that my Christianity actually stands against my bigotedness and my narrow-mindedness. It doesn't support it. It actually confronts it and holds me accountable for it. It tells me that that's wrong. There are some versions of Christianity where that may not be true, some interpretations of Christianity where that may not be true. But in certainly biblical Christianity holds me to account for that. And what I'm arguing is even that conservative Bible-believing evangelical culture out there that I have a lot of problems with and I would have a lot of criticisms of, one of my criticisms would not be that they would stand up and defend bigotry as bigotry. I mean, they wouldn't. They know it's wrong. They know their Bible too well to know the importance of love and what that implies and what that entails. They may not see some of the ways that they are thoughtless and insensitive and narrow-minded and bigoted. They may not see that, but it's not their Christianity that supports it. It's their lack of self-knowledge that is the problem. And like you point out, what culture can you point to where you don't find individuals with lack of self-knowledge?
It's everywhere. It's rampant.
Yeah.
That isn't helpful in people understanding what we're talking about, is that the views of Christianity are also currently unpopular very often.
In the larger culture? Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, like, for example, a typical gospel-believing Christian does not support abortion. Well, that's a very conservative view that's not accepted in the general culture now. They want free choice for women, and that's what's really being promoted. And so we look very wrong, because we have a lot of stances like that. I would argue, though, that the people who have the other stances cannot allow themselves often to be loving toward Christians who they disagree with. And often I am the recipient of very bigoted behavior and very unloving and very uncompassionate behavior, people who are unwilling to listen to or care about my position, even if it's a very thoughtful position. And I want to go back to this letter. That's one of the things I really appreciated about this letter that we're going to be talking about, is this person was actually asking questions, saying, wait a minute, maybe you do have something to say. Maybe there's something for me to hear.
Yeah.
I realize, Jack, as I'm talking, that I feel my blood pressure rising a little bit. I'm getting a little hot. I can see that the impact of having been the recipient of bigoted behavior or unloving behavior certainly has had an impact on me. And I can see that my temperature could end up being translated into hurtfulness toward other people. And I think that's how this gets promulgated, that I'm being hurt, so I'll hurt you back, so I'll hurt you back. And so that's what's happened here, is we've gotten this war that's been raging, rather than people like me looking at, okay, my temperature's rising here. Is it time for me to see my fear? Or is it time for me to lash back? And I think the answer to that is that it's time for me to look at what I'm afraid of and to soften with my fear and to embrace that and to understand that and to live with that, rather than to harden into my anger and into my negative response toward people. Out of one comes hatred, out of the other comes a soft, vulnerable love that leaves me at risk to be hurt.
I'm not protecting myself, but I am doing what I ought to do. I'm doing what a human being ought to do.
And I think that's what stops the war. Instead of us saying, wait a minute, it's my agenda. No, it's my agenda. And in the process of trying to put across our agenda, like the abortion or non-abortion agenda, we lose the importance of what we could learn through it. The process of going through that, we need to say, wait a minute, what's this say about me? And how do I need to deal differently with me such that I respond to you in a loving, non-protected way? And in any situation, we have the opportunity to do that. I don't think we're taking that opportunity very often in our discussions. Christians and people that don't call themselves Christians alike are not doing well here. And that's because of our humanity again.
Mm-hmm. our humanity, and sometimes I wonder even if our institutions would allow for that kind of interchange on a social political level. I don't know the answer to that, but you know, it's easier. I mean, we have us to deal with, but at least there's the environment in which that kind of love could take place in a one-on-one kind of conversation where we have time to explore, to know one another, to get to know, okay, what are you thinking? Where are you coming from? What's going on here? So much of our social political debate happens through these soundbite media type barbs and charges and insults that we hurl at one another. And is that even a medium that we can have that kind of dialogue through? I don't know, but that doesn't help. I know it doesn't help.
I agree with you there. I don't think we can have those discussions through the media because they're going to take everything and turn what we say around, and it's kind of a dangerous place to be. But most of the time, all of us don't live in that situation.
Right.
I'm living one-on-one with people. The President of the United States is living one-on-one with people. And each of us, from me to him, I have no power. He has lots of power. I have little power. He has lots of power. Can address life in this way, can decide we're going to mature through what's difficult in our life, or to mature, to soften, to become more loving people, or to make the decision not to do that, to become more protected, become hardened. That kind of decision is available to each and every one of us, each and every day. And I think that this man, in writing this letter, was trying to do that. Wait a minute, I'm not just going to rail against you, I'm going to try and understand you. So let's look at the questions that he was trying to address, because I think he really came with that idea in mind.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I need to learn something. I want to learn something. Please help me. So Jack, he has two questions, and I'm going to pass the buck and let you kind of summarize his first question.
Well, I think I'll read it in full, unless you think that would be bad, because I think you get some of the flavor and get a better feel for the question by letting him say it in his own language.
Well, I think that's great, because I was thinking about how to pull this together in a few sentences and thought, well, can't do that. It's Jack's turn. So,
okay, yeah,
good suggestion.
Let me read it. How does anyone ever accept the gospel? I can understand it if people who accept it never think. But if you do think, what do you do? Do you actually believe that the literal Garden of Eden is a more acceptable ontology and cosmology than that provided by astronomical physics and evolutionary biology? Over and over again, I have heard it said on KFAX, this is the station he listens to us on, that Christians should beware of public schools which teach their children evolution. But only once have I heard a serious discussion of how important scientific issues should be addressed. A scientist was on Here's Hank, which broadcasts about 2 a.m., and he was defending intelligent design. God created species and organs. They did not evolve. After some interesting discussions, a caller phoned in and asked Hank if he agreed with this, and Hank, the moderator, said, no, Genesis and the Garden of Eden must be taken literally as fact, or else the gospel of Jesus Christ could not be accepted. The scientist said, I don't have to worry about this because I am a Catholic and we accept the Garden of Eden as allegory. I was amazed, even in the middle of the night. And it is not just the Garden of Eden you must accept, if I understand your position correctly. You have to believe that God made the world in 6 days. You believe this, or do you? Now, I know that I accept whatever ontology and cosmology is presented in the New York Times Science Tuesday on faith. Is that the same kind of faith as accept the Garden of Eden on faith, or Jonah surviving being eaten by a whale? Now you might say, well, you are a perfect candidate in me for Unitarianism, or some faith not so far from you that is my home. I am actually interested in hearing how you accept these things. Now at this point, I must admit that I believed through the 1980s that the Soviet Union was a system that was morally competitive with Europe and the U.S., so that I am used to accepting what are basically absurd premises. I do not begin by believing they are absurd. Actually, I believe the premise was absurd at the end of the belief, not the beginning. Okay, so if I can summarize what I think is the question is, how can someone believe the gospel, which seems to go along together in the question with the scriptures? How can one accept the scriptures and what those scriptures represent to us? if you are a thinking person, if you are somebody who wants to rationally inquire in order to arrive at truth, why would you end there? Why would you arrive at accepting the gospel, embracing the gospel, accepting the scriptures and all that they present?
He's saying, how could you, if you're a thinking person, and you must have to throw away all the other evidence?
Yes, yeah.
So how can you be thinking and throw away all the other evidence?
Yeah, those seem incompatible, that you'd be an honest inquirer on the one hand, and yet you would ignore all that evidence that points to the modern theories of the origin of the universe, evolutionary biology, the assessment of the ancient literature as mythological and fantastic in its nature. I mean, how do you ignore all that and still maintain any kind of integrity as an honest inquirer? Yeah.
And I think underneath it, he's saying, those can't go together. You can't do that.
Right. Right. So that's a challenging question. I mean, that's a very good question. How should we think about all that?
And I have to admit, what I told you when we arrived here today, Jack, was, boy, I'm sure glad you're here to talk about this, because this is a big one to bite off.
Yeah, it is. It's a huge question. Let me start by saying that there's no simple answer to that question, and I think the writer of this letter will understand why and will appreciate this. I mean, if he had been asked 20 years ago or however many years ago, why do you accept the hope of Marxism? Why do you accept the basic promise of Marxism? Why do you accept that? He probably couldn't have given an easy answer to that question. I mean, it's not like he just had two simple reasons why he put his faith in Marxism. It's probably a combination of dozens or hundreds of reasons that lie behind why this strikes you as plausible on the one hand and even to the point of being true on the other hand. And I would say the same thing about my faith, my commitment to the truth of Christianity. I can't give an easy answer to that question. There are dozens, hundreds of reasons that all are bound together and interplay with one another that go into forging for me a conviction that this is true. And they range anywhere from how else can I make sense out of history to certain philosophical perspectives that I have that are much more compatible with a biblical worldview than another worldview, to very intimately personal issues like how much it makes sense out of my own existence in a way that nothing else around me does. And they're all working together. They're all working in conjunction with one another to kind of, I mean, these are these little threads that all wound together create the rope that is supporting the faith that I have, that my conviction that Christianity is true. And, you know, if we take any one of these little strands alone, it may not seem all that impressive, but it's there, it's substantive, but it may not support the weight of, you know, why I'm going to base my whole life on the fact that Christianity is true. But it's not the only reason. I mean, it's not the only evidence. It's not the only argument. It's not the only motive for my embracing Christianity as true. There are all kinds of them, and I'm not even sure I could even identify all of them. I'm not even sure I could articulate all of them. Most of our reasons for believing what we believe are inarticulate because they're tacit. They're not explicit. They're hidden in the depths of my own intuition. And I don't think that's just true of Christianity. I think that's true of any belief system. Why does anybody believe what they believe? Well, they probably can't articulate all the reasons that they have for believing that it's true. Should we make an effort to do so? Yeah, I think so. I think that's a very legitimate, responsible, intelligent thing to do, is as best we can ferret out of our intuitions what are those things lurking there in the depths of my intuition that form the foundation for why I believe this is true. And I want to go partway down that road today.
What you're saying, Jack, in review is, sir, you have a very good, well thought out question, and it's difficult. And to that difficult question, I don't have an easy answer. It's not going to be simple. It's not going to be easy to do. Bear with us. let us go down a couple of roads and see where we get with it. But I think that's exactly what we're going to do here, Jack, is have to travel down some roads.
Yeah.
It might even be pretty messy, usually in trying to approach this kind of thing. If we're too smooth about it, if we think we've got too much, then I think what we're doing is overlooking a lot that really is subconscious. Mm-hmm. And that's hard, very hard to get at.
Yeah, exactly. And as a way of, one more thing as a way of preface to where I want to go, I've been reading recently, I'm a tutor at Gutenberg College, and we read a lot of different people, but one of my favorites is Kierkegaard. We actually did a couple of earlier programs on Kierkegaard. But I'm reading one of his works that I've never read before, which is probably his most important philosophical work. It's called The Concluding Unscientific Postscript to the Philosophical Fragments. That's the title.
That's even a hard title to remember.
Yeah. What Kierkegaard is saying here, I used to reject this, I would imagine. I would have really had a reaction to it. But because I've grown to trust Kierkegaard more, I'm more open to hear what he says. And he's persuading me that he's right. And that is, he raises the question, okay, what if someone were to come along and prove to you that the Bible was not all it was cracked up to be, and that it doesn't have the authority that it does. It wasn't even written by the people that you thought it was written by. It's really not, has no right to play the authoritative role in your life that it does. So what? Does that mean that you're not still confronted by the claims of Christ and Christianity? And to that he says, well, no, of course not. Now, he is assuming that there is a Christ who really was there, who really did say something, and the apostles really did teach what they taught. But do we have a record of that? Do we have a reliable record of that? Well, what if someone could prove to us that we don't? Does that trash Christianity? Does that mean that we shouldn't believe? Does it leave us with nothing? And he says, no, because it leaves us without a Bible, perhaps. Okay. But we still have a decision to make. The fundamental underlying claims of Christianity ultimately come down to a decision that I as an individual need to make. And what's the big, huge barrier that stands between me and believing the truth, me and embracing and committing my life to the truth that Jesus came to teach? Is it not enough evidence? Is it that I really don't know if the Bible is really reliable? Is it any sort of intellectual question at all? And basically what he's trying to say is, there's a mile-wide gap between me and the belief that is moral and spiritual in nature. And that is an impossible gap to get over. It's an unbridgeable gap. And I'm worried about whether or not I'm absolutely certain whether the Bible is reliable. What he's trying to do is put this in perspective. Do we have intellectual questions? Sure, we have intellectual questions. Absolutely. All kinds of things that could be thrown up in the air and looked at critically and doubted, and we wonder about, and we don't know if it's really true. We're really fuzzy about whether I should think about it this way or this other way. Are those problems? Yeah, sure, those are problems. But those problems are minuscule in comparison to this huge problem that we have, and that is, I don't want to go there. I have this moral, spiritual allergy to embracing the absolute truth, the truth that Jesus came into the world to confront us with. And that's such a huge problem that has to be gotten over, that the intellectual problems kind of pale by comparison. They just kind of fade into insignificance by comparison. I think he's right to put these things in proper perspective.
Well, Jack, I even think that their intellectual questions are really just shadows of our moral questions. And sometimes in addressing those, we lose track that there are really moral issues underneath it.
Exactly.
But I think that's what's generating our intellectual questions. If we look far enough underneath, that's
right.
What's really going on here. As I often do, I'd like to make a comment about the process of what's going on here for me as you're talking. I'm finding myself, quite honestly, kind of going in and out of staying with you. Something that crossed my mind was, oh man, I don't think I'm up to this. I couldn't even remember the title of that paper by Kierkegaard. Kierkegaard is even a name that's hard to remember to say. So I think a lot of people could, at this point, click out. Because it feels so challenging. The things that are common for you to think about, for you to grapple with, are not common for me to grapple with in the way that you do. And I think that's true for most people in the universe, Jack.
Okay.
But I think that it's a worthy thing to try and do that. I think that it's right for me to try and bring my mind, not just because I'm on this broadcast and it's my job, but it's a right thing to try and bring my mind back to this for a couple of reasons. One is because it sharpens my mind. If nothing else, it helps me keep living longer because a mind that's working well is a mind that is going to live longer. It's going to be functioning better for a longer time. So just on that level, if it motivates somebody.
Well, and it ultimately fortifies our faith, I would argue. I mean, my faith is so much the stronger for having grappled with the questions that I've grappled with.
And I would say that and underline that a million times. If we don't grapple with these questions, our faith really remains rather thin, and something can push us off the Grand Canyon very quickly.
Right.
And the next question that this man addresses is, when real tragedy comes, when real Holocaust comes, what about your faith then? And if we haven't grappled with these questions, our faith can just tumble out from under us, or we become rigid, unloving people who are just what we were talking about in the beginning, bigoted, fragile, hurtful people that are having to defend it just out of that thinness. And then we're left unloving people again.
Yeah.
But, Jack, although I think we really need to grapple with questions, we don't often have to grapple with them in this challenging of a way. And so what I would encourage people to do is come along with me. I'm not as bright as Jack. I really have to work at it. I don't think in this way. But let's work together. And I'll try and ask questions that help me understand it. And perhaps in my trying to address it, you will be able to think about it more clearly along with me.
Yeah. And let me try to get at it another way that doesn't use the language that Kierkegaard uses, but maybe this will make it clear. Let's suppose, just for the sake of argument, I don't believe this is the case, but let's suppose that Jesus came into the world, Son of God, that we claim that he is, with the authority to reveal to the light of the world, as John calls him, with the authority to let mankind in on what God was doing in the world. And he taught a few people that he calls the apostles and sent them out to relay to other people what he had taught them. But nothing had ever been written down. We don't have a Bible at all. And let's say we don't have the words of the prophets from the Old Testament, from the Torah. We don't have a Bible at all. Well, what then? Is there no truth because we don't have it written? Could the fact that we have this sort of faint echo of something that this man Jesus told somebody sometime that kind of got passed down in distorted form, is that nothing? Well, no, it's not nothing. If it was the truth, it's the truth. Just because I don't have an authoritative, reliable witness to that truth doesn't mean that there wasn't something back there somewhere worth doing the best I can to try to figure out what did he say, because it was the light of the world. You know, it was the truth itself. Isn't there still something that I need to confront, find, discover, and confront, even if it's not as conveniently presented to me as it is in the scripture? I think that's what Kierkegaard is saying is, well, sure, there's still something there that you have to do business with, even if it's not in your Bible. There's something out there that entered into history, and it is so important, it is of such eternal importance, that we have to discover it as best we can and do business with it. That's just an objective reality. Unless none of that's true. But in which case, I have to figure that out. Because I have to confront the challenge that the Christian faith itself presents to the whole world. Here's a man who claimed to come into the world and tell us what it was all about. What are you going to do with that? What are you going to do about that?
So how does that have to do with his question, Jack?
Well,
we're going to apply it.
We're just putting it in. It just puts all of these intellectual questions in perspective, because the first question I have to ask is, this claim that Jesus is making, why am I rejecting it? Am I rejecting it because I have some questions about whether or not it's really true? Or am I rejecting it because I don't want it to be true? And I think what's behind what Kierkegaard is saying is, our fundamental problem is we are so personally short-sighted that we don't even want it to be true. Never mind the intellectual doubts we have a much bigger problem than that. I don't want it to be true, and all the proof in the world is not going to change that. If I don't want it to be true and I don't want it to be my truth, I ain't going to make up my truth, no matter how many arguments and proofs and evidence and stuff that you trot out there. And that's the much bigger problem that we all face.
And why is it that we so much don't want the gospel to be true?
Well, fundamentally, the Bible's answer to that is that we are, by our own nature as human beings, we are rebels against God. We are hostile to God. We hate God. That comes naturally to us. And that, in fact, to be open to God and who He is and what He's doing and how He's running His universe does not come naturally. It takes a supernatural miracle from God to change me, to change my dispositions enough that I'm really even open to receiving the truth.
What's the awful truth that I don't want to accept? That's I'm so, as you said, allergic to.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's a number of them. One is we would prefer to believe that we are peers of God or even a bit above Him, superior to Him. And yet the awful truth that the Bible presents is that He is the Creator and we are mere creatures. We are, if you will, pawns in a game that He has invented. I'm putting it in a deliberately negative way because that's how it feels to us. And so we react to that. You know, we hate that. That very idea is offensive to us.
Yeah, one of the things that we clamor for most is to have some control in our lives, and
exactly.
That really gives God control and ultimately not us.
Yeah, exactly. So that's a big one. That's a huge one that we find really obnoxious. And then it gets worse. We would like to think of ourselves as really basically pretty good, decent, worthy people, creatures.
If you dig far enough down, you're going to see the good in you.
Yeah, we'll see what a basically good guy I am. And the Bible says exactly the opposite. If you dig down far enough, you find out how fundamentally flawed, unworthy, evil you are. The depth of our self-centeredness, our self-grasping, our egocentric orientation as opposed to being other-oriented, other-directed, we really are fundamentally selfish in an evil, cruel, hostile, vicious kind of way. That's what I'm really made of. Well, we don't like to think of ourselves that way. We don't mind recognizing that other people are selfish, but we have a real allergy to being willing to say that of ourselves and see that, perceive ourselves that way.
Or I think it's okay to see myself as maybe selfish in two or three or ten areas, but not across the board, not who I am. That's not my whole being.
Yeah.
And that's what the gospel says. It's really your whole being.
Yeah, exactly. The whole idea of God becoming man who's going to be king, at least as an American, you know, all of my American sensibilities rebel at the notion of bowing to any monarchy. I don't care who he is. And so the whole idea of Jesus being king is, I think, obnoxious to me and people from my culture. There may be other cultures that don't have so much problem with that, but I have a problem with that. And what ultimately lies behind that is something that is more deeply human. That kind of pride and arrogance that doesn't want to submit to nothing, nowhere, no how. You know, I want to be king. If we're electing kings, let's make me it.
Yeah. Or at least somebody that I really agree with.
Yeah, and that I choose. That is my choice.
That doesn't really bump me at all. That doesn't make it difficult for me. I think another thing that makes it very difficult truth to accept is that we like to accept the kind of love that is kind of from nurturing, from warmth, from kind of a mother cuddling her baby kind of feel that's very safe and warm. The kind of love that expresses itself through giving us insider wisdom through suffering also is something that we really don't want. And that's what God authors in our lives so much of the time, is that it is through the suffering that we go through that we are challenged to look at and understand life in a different way, to see who God is, to see who we are.
Absolutely.
And that is a very difficult teaching tool.
Yeah. And most of the world end up hating God for that.
Because my inalienable right is to be happy, not to hurt.
Yeah.
And hurting doesn't have any value at all in a lot of people's minds.
And so what an awful, terrible God he is who would run the universe in such a way that it would allow such suffering. Yeah, absolutely. And we just hate that. We find that outrageous from our perspective. So those are all moral and spiritual hurdles that we ultimately have to get over. We have to be given different eyes to see life differently, to have a different attitudinal response toward God in order to even be open to the possibility that this is true. And I like what you said earlier. It's absolutely true that many of our intellectual problems aren't really our questions. They're not ultimately deep down profound questions for us. They are more the mask that my rebellion is wearing. I don't want to believe this. Let me have a reason why I don't believe it.
And I don't think we're doing that consciously.
No. Mm-mm. No.
I think the reason that we don't believe things on an intellectual level makes a whole lot of sense to us. But I have found, Jack, in my life that if I look at the surface of the issues in my life, I'm really misdirected. I have to always look deeper because it's coming from something else that oftentimes I'm not even aware of.
Right. And I'm not saying by that that any of the questions themselves are illegitimate. They are legitimate questions, which makes them a good mask for my rebellion to wear. What you're suggesting is that there's just something a whole lot deeper going on there. And a little bit of self-discovery can ultimately reveal that to us.
Or maybe a lot of self-discovery that takes a lot of time and a lot of suffering to get to.
Yeah.
But you're right. I really agree that the questions are appropriate. But then if we get some answers to the questions, but we cannot allow ourselves to even hear those answers or consider them or to bring them in or to do any of those things, we've got to ask ourselves the questions, or I think it's appropriate to ask ourselves the question, okay, what else is going on here then?
I have a colleague at McKinsey Study Center who grew up basically an atheist and prided himself in his intellectual integrity and his rational approach to life. And he describes his high school experience of always being evangelized by Christians who were trying to argue with him about the truth of Christianity and would trot out their evidences, and he would trot out his arguments and his evidences and so on and so forth. And he's very, very bright and I'm sure was always winning these arguments. But the beginning of the end for him as an atheist was he was in an argument one day and from his perspective, he won the argument. But there was a kind of epiphany that when he went away from the argument, having won the argument, somehow there was something that got said or something about the way he interacted with the person that it raised the question in his own mind, but what if you had lost the argument? If you had lost the argument, would you be willing to believe? Somehow that question got raised. Mm-hmm. And he went away, spent a sleepless night, as I think he tells the story, coming to realize that he didn't believe because he didn't think it was rational. He didn't believe because he didn't want to believe. And that really shook him to the core, because his whole self-concept was one of a completely rational, intelligent human being who wanted his beliefs to have intellectual integrity, and he was going to believe whatever was rational to believe. And he realized that actually the truth about him was he wasn't willing to believe Christianity, even if it was rational to believe it, that he just wasn't willing to believe it. And it was that moment of self-discovery that started him down the road that ultimately led in him becoming a believer.
It was that moment of recognition of irrationality.
Exactly.
That he couldn't live with, both having integrity with being a rational person and not being a rational person here.
Yeah.
Did I say that right?
Yeah, I mean, it destroyed his own self-concept, you know, it called that into question, as well as what a human being ought to be. I mean, his self-concept was a good one. We ought to aspire to be people of intellectual integrity, but he discovered that that's not what I am.
That's not what I have.
And so, what's going on here?
It's amazing that someone would come to that recognition, and I think it's a miracle.
Yeah.
It's an amazing thing. Jack, we have about 3 minutes. So where are we? How are we going to tackle this question?
So we haven't even really got to the question. We'll have to leave that to next week, I guess. But let me just briefly say, biblical Christianity is indeed all about intellectual respectability. A lack of intellectual respectability, a lack of following truth wherever it leads, a lack of an anti-intellectual bias is not compatible with biblical Christianity. Now, you'll find all kinds of Bible-believing conservative Christians who are fundamentally anti-intellectual in their orientation. That's true. There are many of them out there. They are afraid. They are dogmatic. They are dogmatic because of their fear. Their faith is not a faith that they hold because they are intellectually convinced, but it's a faith that they're loyal to for cultural, psychological, emotional reasons. You're going to find all kinds of evidence of that out there in Christianity. But that's not because that's what the Bible has encouraged them to do or be. It's in spite of the fact that the Bible is inviting us to test and see if God is not who he says he is, to examine, to explore, to discover. And God gave us our rationality, our rational minds, to that very end, that we would explore the truth, search for the truth, make my whole life a quest for the truth, and seek to find it. So the spirit of the inquiry that the question is asking us to enter into is fully conforms to the spirit of the Bible itself. Yes, if this is not true, we don't want to believe it. If this is based on a bunch of falsehoods and fictions and fairy tales and myths, then we should be the first to reject it and say, this has a foundation that is not worth resting my life on. So the spirit of the question is exactly the right spirit, and it's one that I applaud, that I embrace, and that I think the Bible encourages me in. So we will look at that next week.
What we need to do, you're saying, is we need to ask any question, and we need to ask all questions, and we need to take them seriously. And that even though many times we see the Christian culture as anti-intellectual, it's not because the Bible or Jesus encouraged that. It's probably because of our humanity that we make it anti-intellectual because of our fears.
Exactly. Yeah.
And how do we know that God wants us to approach the gospel in this way and not? Because a lot of Christians would say that this is really wrong. I think the argument that you made is God gave us a mind to do that. And I would say also that the way Jesus approached people was very intellectual. He really challenged people to think. He did not come out with parables that made a lot of sense on the surface. He had to think about them. Mm-hmm. I think the whole Bible is written in a very intellectual way.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of study to understand it. You can't just sit down and have a simple reading of, say, Romans and expect to understand it. You simply don't. If we think we do, we've really missed it.
Yeah.
So I think there's evidence both by the mindset God gave us and by the way he wrote scripture that says, come on, people, think about it.
Jack and Christine will return in a moment. Almost 20 years ago, the Mackenzie Study Center in Eugene, Oregon, was created as a place where people could come and seriously think about their faith. Over the years, Mackenzie has grown in different directions and gone through various changes, but one thing has remained constant: a passionate love of God's Word and the truth it contains. The Mackenzie staff is dedicated to studying and understanding the Bible. Individually, they want to know what the biblical authors meant when they wrote the Bible. They want to peel away layers of false teaching and get to the very heart of the biblical message. And this is not easy. It's hard work. It requires years of dedication and the willingness to believe what the Bible actually says rather than what they might want it to say. These men and women also believe their studies and their teaching are not perfect. They know their understanding is limited, and they may be wrong, but they trust God to give them the eyes to clearly see his truth. They also encourage others to join them in their efforts, to ask them tough questions, to challenge their conclusions, and to take the Bible seriously. More importantly, they desire that all may come to the wonderful saving truth of the gospel. Much of the teaching done at Mackenzie is available on tape and can be ordered from the tape catalog. Papers and the free monthly newsletter News and Views are also available. Information about how you can find out more about Mackenzie Study Center and its ministries will be given at the end of today's program. Now, let's return to Jack and Christine.
It has been really exciting, a really good thing for Jack and I to get together and dialogue about so many different issues with the backdrop of the Bible, trying to understand the Bible better, trying to understand how it fits into our lives in a real, practical way. In addition to the radio, we've been trying to think about what are some other ways that we can dialogue with our listening audience and with other people to perhaps even expand the audience that wants to listen to what's being taught here at Christianity at Work. So we came up with the idea of offering seminars or workshops to people out there in your community. We would like to offer this for a weekend retreat, for a women's group, for your support group, for a men's group, a women's group, a home group, for your church, for schools, for colleges, just about any group that wants to get together and put together a workshop. We'd be really excited to help you out. The format that we're thinking about is an interactive one. Just as you hear on Christianity at Work, Jack and I are interacting with each other. The topic could be one of your choice. It is really wide open for us. What you want to have us present, we'd be very happy to do that. We also appreciate the dialogue between ourselves and our listening audience. We've had a couple of times where we've gone out to different communities, and that has just been a wonderful thing to get to know you, to see you, to interact with you personally, face to face. So your questions would be a big part of what we would do in any seminar. Depending on the response, we may not be able to meet everybody's needs, but we're going to try and do the best that we can. If you're interested in this, we invite you to contact McKinsey Study Center. It's at 1-883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And the telephone number is 541-485-4801. And those addresses will be, and phone number will be repeated at the end of the program. We hope to hear from you.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKinsey Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about McKinsey Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under McKinsey Study Center or Gutenberg College. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The McKinsey staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the McKinsey staff through classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The McKinsey Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to McKinsey, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to McKinsey Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKinsey Study Center, thank you for listening.